Hi, I'm Otto. Welcome to Erin Sarah's podcast.
All right, we have Dr. Marissa Franco here. She is a psychologist and friendship expert. And you know, we love to talk about friendship.
Also, can you tell us what we should call you? Should we call you doctor? Should we call you Marissa? Should we call you Dr. Franco? How do we converse with you?
Yes, thank you for asking. I actually go by, this is like a tiny change, Dr. Marissa G. Franco on first mention, because there's another Marissa Franco who's quite popular, but then you can just call me Marissa.
Okay, Marissa, amazing. Okay, so Marissa, you wrote a book that we really want to dive into called Platonic. It's how the science of attachment can help you make and keep friends. So attachment styles, there's a famous book called Attached, right? Is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. And it's really focused on your romantic relationships and how your attachment styles affect the people you choose, the people that you are drawn to, and your habits and relationships. But it really focuses just on romantic relationships. And your book really explores this huge this white space that we aren't talking about, which is really focusing on the friends we choose, the friends we keep, the people we're drawn to, and how we operate in our friendships, and how your attachment style really dictates those relationships, and how important friendships are, A, the friendship in our romantic relationship, and B, are how important our friendships are in our life. So we just have so many questions for you. Can you take us, can you just start by giving us sort of your history and kind of what got you to focusing on this?
Yeah. So when I was in my young 20s, I went through a few breakups and they made me feel really, really bad. And I decided to start this wellness group with my friends, sort of like a place that I could heal, where we cooked, we meditated, we did yoga together. We just met it up each week to practice wellness. And I realized a few things through that group. The first was, wow, I think I took these breakups really bad because of how I viewed traditional romantic love. And I thought, I need one person to complete me. This is the only love that makes me lovable. This is the only love that makes me worthwhile. And the fact that my friends love me didn't matter. And I think that group made me face the idea that, like, this love feels so powerful to me. This love feels so healing. Why is it that this love doesn't really matter? I really began to question that. And so I kind of figured, well, this isn't just me who has these conceptions about, you know, having to find one person to complete us and feeling like your worth is dependent, especially as a woman, on your ability to find a spouse. And I think this is a larger cultural issue where we don't value other forms of love. And that really is to our detriment and our harm, just like it had been for myself. So I really started to look into books, research on the science of friendship, because I really wanted to find a resource that would treat friendship as sacred as how I had come to find it.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about how important friendship is that we take for granted in our romantic relationships. So my husband and I have been reading this book. I'm sure you know who John Gottman is, like the godfather of relationship experts. And it's the 7 principles to making a marriage work, 7 principles to a happy marriage. And one of the, I don't know if one of the principles is friendship, but one of the topics in one of the chapters is everybody asks, every couple asks how to keep the passion alive. How do you stay, you know, passionate about each other, turned on by each other, connected sexually, and that the root of all passion is friendship. That every couple that he looked at, statistically, the people who stayed passionate are the people who had a strong friendship. Because when you like each other, you're attracted to each other. And it makes so much sense that, like, we forget sometimes to nourish that friendship.
Absolutely. Yeah. The science does show that, like, how much you feel like you're friends with your partner predicts how satisfied, even how good your sex is. And it's funny because I don't think we're always encouraged to make sure that you choose a life partner that you would always also be friends with, right? I think sometimes we're just so focused on the idea of, like, chemistry or the spark that we're not thinking more holistically about things we would value in a friend. Like, I don't know, compatibility, shared values, shared life plan, all these other important things.
I really feel like we talk a lot about female friendships because for me, you know, I truly feel like I get things from my female friendships that I just can't get from my romantic partner, that I can't get from my sister, that I can't get from my children. I mean,
I'm right here.
I crave it. And I think that especially in the pandemic, so many females that I knew, of course, people were going through depression and mental health challenges for a million reasons, but the common thing was they didn't have the connection of their platonic female friendships. And it was truly like taking a toll on their mental health. And it wasn't until we were just not even allowed to have it that I know for me, like, I really took inventory of my female friendships. And it was a real wake-up call. Like, these are relationships that mean so much to me that I have to put work into. The same way that I have to put work into my, what's a not platonic friendship?
A romantic relationship.
A romantic.
She doesn't even know what it is. That's how bad it is.
I don't even know what it is. But like we talk on this podcast, you get things from your platonic relationships that you cannot get anywhere else.
I think absolutely. And that's just like one of the most powerful things that I think friendship does is it expands our sense of our identity. And I think when we're around the same person all the time, we just have one experience of ourselves, right? Because like, if I love race cars, my spouse hates race cars, that's just a side of me that's going to get dusty unless I have like a larger community of people to bring out all these different aspects of myself. So I think, you know, that's another thing that happened without friends and without larger community. We all just had this sense that like we were just shrinking as people and in our identities.
Yeah. And if I'm being honest, you know, like, let's be real. Like I'm in a 16-year-long relationship. My, let's call him my spouse. We're not married, but whatever. He's my spouse. You know, you can catch yourself really being an autopilot. You're not really holding up a mirror to that person anymore. You're going about your day. You're exhausted. You're stressed. You're trying to like stay afloat. My girlfriends are really the ones that hold me accountable in a lot of ways. And I don't know. I mean, it's just,
no matter how healthy your romantic relationship is, like I'm in an earlier, like a younger relationship than Sarah is. And so we're still very, very connected to each other. Even so, even though he's my best friend, I still go out to a girl's dinner and I get fed something that is like, it like is, I can feel the energy of it. Recently, I used to have a lot of guy friends, and it's not that I like don't because I'm married, but you know, you all kind of marry off and it's like,
Simon got rid of all your guys.
He cut them all out. No, when my guy friends started getting married and then we got married, it stopped being like a clique of people, you know, like you start to hang out with your spouse's friends as well. And like your life just starts to change. And recently I started really missing my guy friends. And I texted Nico and Kivas, two of my old guy best friends. And I was like, can we have dinner just the three of us, no spouses? Because I miss
that. Did they respond?
Yeah, they said yes, but we haven't made the plan yet. Mm. But we all got excited at this idea of being around each other again and not having our partners with us because it just changes the dynamic. You know, like there's something about that authentic, pure friendship where no one wants to have sex with each other. Well, hopefully they do want to have sex with me, but you're not going to do it. And it's just different. It's so important. So I want to go through and give people.
Can I say before you just go there, I just want to say that I get so many messages from women, you know, more so asking about, can you give me tips on how to make friends? Can you give me tips on how to maintain healthy female friendships? Can you, way more so than I'm single, I don't have a romantic relationship.
I don't really like women, the voice that you're giving to that single girl right now. You're just giving her like,
oh, sorry,
I'm single.
No, but like, I do think, and I don't know if it's because of, you know, the pandemic or what it is, but I feel on a much larger scale, women craving connection with other women more than I've ever felt.
Mm, absolutely. I think the pandemic certainly has contributed to that because we have gotten lonelier in the pandemic. And there are particular types of friendship that actually I think men tend to have that really took a beating during the pandemic, like these companionate friends where we usually spend time together and we do an activity. We go to the game together. We play a sport together. And our friendship wasn't bounded in shared vulnerability and support, which a lot of us were able to still access in our friendships in the pandemic. And so I think those friendships, those companionate friends in particular, is really hard. Really
but
hard
I also know women who are married, okay? Some have kids, some don't, and they feel lonely because they don't have their community of platonic relationship. So again, I just...
But what she said was interesting because what you're saying is that a lot of male friendships are based around an activity, like going to a game or something, and they weren't able to have that in the pandemic.
Yes.
And it's so true. Male friendships are so like hobby-based. It's so fascinating. Girls are like, hey, do you want to come over for no reason? Just come over and sit on my couch. Guys,
drink wine.
Guys don't really do that. They're like, it has to be. That's so funny. It's so true. Okay, so I want to take the audience through attachment styles so that we can have a base for what we're talking about. So, and this is from your book that I'm reading this from. So we have a secure attachment. And I want you to take us through after I describe them. You can kind of explain like how these come about and how they operate in our friendship.
And listeners, don't just skip past this. Cause I sometimes when we're bringing in like hardcore facts, people are like, oh, it's overwhelming. You cannot skip past this. This is so eye-opening.
It's interesting.
It's beyond.
Okay. Secure attachment. Secure people.
Not either one of us. Keep going.
Sarah. Secure attachment. Secure people assume that they are worthy of love and others can be trusted to give it to them. This belief becomes an unconscious template that trickles into their life relationships, leading them to give others the benefit of the doubt, open up, ask for what they need, support others, assume others like them, and achieve intimacy. All right, let's talk about secure attachment.
Not either one of us.
They're like our gold standards for friendship. They initiate more. They can work through conflict better. They're less likely to dissolve friendships. They're generally less stressed about life, more regulated, experience less health problems, experience more satisfaction in their jobs. So I think the whole book is basically like asking the question, how can we all become more secure knowing the benefits of it for our friendships?
And is there a way to become a secure attachment style person when you weren't that before?
Absolutely. Yes. Your attachment style can certainly change over time. And some research finds that most of our attachment style will change over time. And it can also be different in different kinds of relationships. And one of the tips that I share in the book related to making friends is the idea that if you want to make friends, you need to assume people like you. And this is something that, again, secure people assume, because according to the research, there's a study on something called the acceptance prophecy, where when researchers basically lied to people and said, you're going to go into this group and be accepted, that made people open, warmer, friendlier, more positive, and they actually were more likely to be accepted.
That's so true. Like I feel the most, I mean, this makes sense, but like the people I feel I'm drawn to the most in my friendships are the people who see the best in me. Like it's really hard for me to maintain friendships with people that I was friends with in high school because they saw the worst version of me and they still sort of assume that that's who I am. And so I'm like super triggered by them, you know?
Yeah. And it's hard to be authentic around people because I talk about authenticity and how we can access in the book, and it's hard to define, right? People are like, it's your true self. What the heck is a true self? And so I define it as really just who we are when we feel most safe and we're not hijacked by all of our defenses of our ego.
Can we talk about when these attachment styles develop? How does someone develop a secure attachment? What kind of parents did they have? What kind of childhood did they have?
Yeah, so really healthy parenting, which means that your parents are responsive to your needs, right? You cry, you need support. They're there to comfort you. They're not telling you, you know, get over it. Why are you upset? Why are you crying, right? Even if you need to like sort of pull away, they can notice those cues in their children. So they're not overbearing, which you tend to see with more anxious parents of anxiously attached people, where, you know, if you're sort of pulling away, the parent lets you pull away because they don't take it personally. This is a securely attached parent, doesn't take what their baby does personally. So they're allowed to attune to their baby and think about what does my baby need instead of what makes me feel good or validated as a parent.
This is important because this is obviously, we're talking about platonic friendships, but parents listening, people listening who want to be parents one day, this is so important to understand that you are responsible for the attachment style that your child, who then will become an adult, has. Mm-hmm. And Aaron and I were raised being told not to cry. We were raised being told like, toughen up. Why are you crying? This shouldn't upset you. And it fucked me up. And I am a total, we'll get to what my attachment style is. It's definitely not the secure attachment, but I'm so cognizant with my girls of like, I don't think I've ever told them not to cry. Even when like, I'm like, Jesus, stop fucking crying. I mean, you can't have a cookie. I mean, don't cry. I'm so nervous to tell them not to cry because of how I was raised.
Yeah, absolutely. I try to say, I love that you're releasing your feelings when people cry, because I just think we all need to normalize it more.
I also think about how much parents, how often parents really make their parenting about their own experience instead of their child's experience. And I see that in a lot of parents, that they really feel like you're living your life to fulfill their wishes and make them feel good. And we see that in parents that, you know, deny a child's sexuality because it makes the parent uncomfortable. And I think back to a positive experience from my childhood when I was a teenager and I was desperate to go away to boarding school in Switzerland when I was 15 years old. And my mom's friends were like, no chance I would ever let my kid go there because they're too far away and I would worry about them and blah, blah, blah. And my mom was like, yeah, that stuff's going to be hard for me.
And dad. I mean, they both let me go.
But they were like, my mom mostly was like, it's not about me. I'm proud that my daughter wants to have this adventure, that she wants to experience living in another country at such a young age. And so it's going to be hard for me, but it's going to be good for her. And that's what's important. And I look back at how impactful that experience was for me because my mom put herself second and put me first.
Absolutely. And that is what secure attachment does. It's like, I have enough strength to be able to let you live your authentic life without feeling like I need to control it so I can control my own feelings. So just an example of like anxiously attached move that I did that I talk about in the book, I talk about how important it is to show affection towards friends. Like it's one of the factors that predict whether your friendships sustain, and how I had this friend and I would compliment her and she would always reject it. And she'd be like, no, I'm not that great. Blah, 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 blah. Like, just turn down my compliment, to the extent that one time I literally said to her, you can't turn down my compliment. And then I shared the compliment and I talked to this scholar on affection, Corey Floyd, and he told me, hey, Marissa, affection actually has three parts. You feel warmly towards someone, you share that warmth and they receive it. And so if they don't receive it, you're not actually showing them affection. And I was like, yeah, because if they're not receiving it, and I'm forcing it upon them, it's more about my ego than them actually feeling loved, right? And I think that's what we see in insecure attachment in general. Like, we navigate our relationships in a way to maintain our ego more than we come from a place of, I guess, pure loving and pure trust and pure ability to allow people to be like the fully formed person that they are, so it doesn't harm us.
So is that basically saying that if you see in a friend, like for you, that the words of affirmation to your friend is how you would feel loved in that relationship, but then if that friend is uncomfortable with the compliment, then you're not really showing her affection the way that she wants to receive it?
Exactly. It doesn't actually count as affection unless they receive it.
So do you have to pivot and figure out, I need to figure out how my friend feels safe in our friendship, how my friend feels loved in our friendship, and give it to her the way that she wants to receive it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you can ask your friend, like, what makes you feel appreciated? How do I make you feel appreciated?
It's
interesting. I think what we're really getting at here is just the self-centeredness of pain, right? Like, when something makes you feel pain, and I would say insecurely attached people just more prone to pain in our relationships, anxious people in particular, avoidant people will tell you they're not in pain, but their physiology tells you that they are, is that we can't, it takes resources and capacity to be like, you're a separate person with your own needs, and how can I consider those? And when we're in pain, we just feel like we don't have that capacity, right? So we just tend to be more self-absorbed, more focused on ourselves, and have more difficult friendship dynamics.
What does that say about a person? Like, for me, when girlfriends of mine, like, you know, tell me like, oh, you're so amazing or blah, 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 it really makes me uncomfortable. Like, not in a like, oh, I want to pull away, but I'm sure it's just that I don't think those things of myself. So when people are saying it, it makes me really uncomfortable. Like, I really struggle getting compliments. Like, it's very hard for me to take a compliment. I always deflect. If someone gives me a compliment, I'm like, oh God, no. Or it's really hard for me to take a compliment from a girlfriend.
Yes. Two things that come to mind there. One, and this is from Danielle Bayer-Jackson, another great friendship expert's work, who she cites research that women's friendships tend to be about keeping an egalitarian relationship. Nobody can be dominant or better than, nobody can be superior. So sometimes specifically for women, there can be triggers around compliments because it's like, I don't want to be better than you. Like we're at the same level, we're at the same plane, like we're friends. The other thing that I found in the research is that, I'm sorry, I'm not saying this about you, but general finding in the research is that if you have low self-esteem, when someone compliments you, it actually feels like an identity crisis.
Oh, no, I do have low self-esteem. It's okay.
She's like, I didn't want to point fingers, but...
But it sounds, I'm like, no, we're episode 65 in this pod. I have low self-esteem. Keep going.
Okay, yes. So it feels like an identity crisis, and it actually feels like pressure. Like, oh, now you're expecting me to be this person that I really am not. And the research actually finds that people with low self-esteem are just more likely to devalue compliments. The unfortunate thing being, actually receiving those compliments is one way to raise your self-esteem. But if it doesn't match your sense of self and you're throwing it out, it gets really hard. It really gets really hard to feel more worthy.
Knowledge is power, ladies. Knowledge is power.
Okay. Knowledge is power. You're right. And you know what? It is September, which means it is the fall. It feels like a new beginning, new season. And I think that modern fertility is something that you should be looking into, because if you have any questions about where you are at with fertility, I have conversations with women all the time.
I'm so annoyed I didn't do this when I was 27. I'm just putting that out there.
Yeah. So many women that are like, I'm 33, I'm 34, I'm not in a relationship, but I just started a big job. I'm not sure if I should freeze my eggs or not. This is the cheapest way for you to figure out where your fertility is at without having to go into a doctor's office and genuinely spend thousands of dollars and run into people that you went to high school with who now know that you're freezing your eggs, which is not what you want to have happen. Modern fertility is the easiest way to check and get a good idea of your egg count, your FSH levels, where you're at, and how urgent it is for you to think about looking into fertility.
By the way, there might be women listening in their late 30s who are like, oh, okay, I have a couple kids, but like, who knows? You might want to have another kid in your 40s, but you don't even know what you're working with. So this is really, I think, from like mid 20s to early 40s, like this is the window. This is for you.
I agree. So right now, Modern Fertility is offering our listeners $30 off the test when you go to modernfertility.com/foster30. This is a limited time offer for $30 off. That means that your test will come to $169 instead of the hundreds or the thousands that it could cost a doctor's office. Get $30 off your fertility test when you go to modernfertility.com/foster30. modernfertility.com/foster30. I personally eat and use Saqqara all the time. And just the other day, our mother, Rebecca, called me with your daughter, Valentina, and said, hey, can you tell me what was in the overnight oats that you had from Saqqara at your house? Because now Valentina said that it's the only thing she wants to eat for breakfast. And now mom was going to try to recreate it at home with me telling her the ingredients. So she's basically trying to steal the ingredients from Saqqara.
Right. So mom is just too cheap to just buy Saqqara. She's trying to plagiarize. Well, good luck, because it won't taste as good. We love you, mom, but you know.
Yeah, it won't. But Saqqara's food is just so, so, so good that even your picky 11-year-old daughter loved it when she came over to my house. It's all organic ingredients. There's no other food delivery service that I'm aware of that uses only plant-based foods, plant-rich, ready-to-eat meals that are functional wellness essentials to your body, and all organic.
Look, at the end of the day, Saqqara, it's a wellness company that is anchored in food as medicine. And that is what we all have to get back to. I think it's just, look, we try to bring you different ways that you can slowly lead a healthier, cleaner lifestyle. And starting with food, I would say, is right
up there.
Important
one.
Yeah.
But Saqqara also has a lot of other things too now. They also have protein powders, they have protein bars, they have granolas, they have tons of other products that are also delicious.
Yeah, we are huge, huge fans of
Saqqara. So right now, Saqqara is offering our listeners 20% off of your first order when you go to saqqara.com/foster or enter the code FOSTER at checkout. That is Saqqara, SAKARA.com/foster to get 20% off your first order. saqqara.com/foster. Well, let's get into the more challenging attachment styles. So next we have anxious attachment. These are people who are anxiously attached, assume others will abandon them. To keep themselves from being abandoned, they act clingy, are overly self-sacrificing to accommodate others, or they plunge into intimacy too rapidly.
And they overshare, right?
Yep, they definitely overshare. Anxiously attached people, if you're not anxious, you're going to be like, why is that person reacting so strongly to this thing that seems small, right? Like the people some of us might want to use the word sensitive for, right? These people with anxious attachment, fundamentally, the distress parts of their brain light up more when something negative happens to them. And they don't pick up cues of acceptance. So they have this problem with what's called negative filtering, meaning that when people love and accept them, they don't really pay attention. But when people sort of reject them, all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, I can't believe you're rejecting me. We also see things like people pleasing in anxiously attached people because they're so afraid people will abandon them that they struggle to be authentic. They struggle to set boundaries because the thought is like, wow, if I do this, they're just going to leave me. So I have to be whoever that person wants me to be. It's anxiously attached people. This can sound kind of harsh, but sometimes they can sort of outsource their sense of self to other people. Like, I need your validation to feel okay. So I'm going to make a lot of demands on you so that you can prove to me that you value me, because that's the only way that I can feel valued within myself.
Okay, this is you, right?
Yeah, this is ringing some dangerous alarm
bells. Didn't want to say it, but bingo! Yeah.
Okay, well, we found my attachment style,
everyone. We found your friendship attachments. Aaron's always the person that's like, hey, nice to meet you. My name's Aaron. I got a nose job. It's like, you want to make people all of a sudden, like,
I don't know how that falls in line with what she said.
No, you're just, because you overshare, and I think it's your way of connecting with people. And I'm always like, dude, chill on the oversharing.
She didn't bring up oversharing, but thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, she did. That is a part of a anxiety.
I didn't hear that part. But what I did hear was the idea of putting sort of unreasonable expectations on people and looking for them to fulfill it to prove that they're, you know, being a good enough friend or whatever. And I definitely feel that. I definitely feel like a mistrust in my relationships where I assume everyone isn't on my side, or I assume everybody doesn't want the best for me, or I like look for the negative reaction and ignore the positive reaction. And by the way, and I really have noticed that take a toll on my friendships because people don't like to feel like I'm
under a microscope.
Yeah. People don't like to feel that I don't trust them or that I don't think that they have my back, you know, or that I'm quick to be like, see, I knew it. You were going to be against me. And, and I really have noticed that taking a toll, and I really want to rectify that. I don't want to be that kind of person, you know?
Yeah. I understand like why it's so hard, right? Cause it's just that you're in pain really, and that you're hurting and you're trying to figure out a solution to it. But you know, that can make it hard for you to understand that like other people have their own needs and have their own lives going on. Right. Because you're always interpreting it through the filter of like, am I getting my needs met? Am I being validated? Am I being loved?
I've thought before sometimes like that, you know, being anxious does sort of make you a narcissist because you're always thinking about
that it's all about you.
It's not even that you think it's all about you. It's just that I've sometimes noticed myself in friendships not be able to be present for showing up for them properly because I'm worrying so much about something in my head. So I'm always sort of spiraling about something or spinning out about something, and it makes it really impossible to listen to what they're going through and give a thoughtful response. And exactly. Not to be like a medicine push or anything, but Zoloft has really helped me with that because it's really quieted a lot of the spinning out of my mind. And I've noticed that I am able to be so much more present for my friends. And I feel so guilty that I haven't been able to be as good of a friend in the past because I really care about my friends and I really care about what they're going through. But sometimes the anxious voice in my head sort of is louder than everything.
Exactly. And I hate throwing out these terms because I'm like, these are people that are suffering and hurting. So it feels weird to, you know, call them out in a negative way. But there's this concept called vulnerable narcissism, right? The traditional narcissism we think about, grandiose narcissism. I think I'm better than everyone. I like to brag about myself. You know, I put people down. But the anxious attachment is actually related to something called vulnerable narcissism, which is more about, I'm so much in pain that I'm literally not regarding you at all. And I'm just thinking about how, what you can do for me to make me not feel like I'm in this much pain.
Oh, I've never heard of that. Vulnerable narcissism.
Yeah.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, I think it does. Because, yeah, I think we think of narcissists as really
loud and
not even that it's intentional, but just that they are like they're exerting their power over you and that they want to dominate, right? Like, I want to dominate the conversation. I want everything to be about me because I'm obsessed with myself and I love myself and I want you to revere me. And I never feel that way, but I think that when you're in your head so much worrying about, did I say the wrong thing just now? Did that not land right? Is someone mad at me? Do I have to rectify the situation? Is that person, like, is that her person being critical?
No,
is that
I don't
person
think that's not happy narcissism, for me? Though.
But I mean, I think we're saying it's a form of it.
Well, Aaron and I always do that. We think everyone's always mad at us. We'll go to a party, we'll leave, and we'll be like, oh my God, we'll spiral about something we said that we shouldn't have said, which probably wasn't that big of a deal, but we just assume that, like, that person's never going to speak to us again, or we've offended them so much, or...
Well, Sarah, we're not to your attachment style yet, because yours is next.
Shut up, Aaron. We're not done
yet. I see it on the paper.
But I just...
We're ready to go into it.
I don't think we're done with anxious. Are we?
Well, it's not being done with it, but I think just creating a landscape of all of them together so we can figure out what things fall into different categories.
What kind of parent... creates an anxious attached child and person?
They're inconsistent. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not there. They're sort of intrusive, like similarly to how anxious people try to get their needs met and they don't consider what the other person is going through. That's what you'll see in anxious parents too. Like, they'll try to get validation from their kids, even if their kid has a need that's like completely unrelated to them, and they'll take it very personally. So they'll sort of try to, a little bit more control their kids' actions and behaviors too, to feel validated themselves.
Now, can there be parenting that creates an anxious attachment style that is not necessarily... Okay, so can the parents getting divorced and a bad breakup happening and parents living in separate houses and going through the chaos of divorce, can that inherently create an insecure attachment style, or sorry, an anxious attachment style, just because of the natural
circumstances, you know,
the instability of the situation?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Divorce has been found in the research to be a factor that contributes to insecure attachment.
Okay, Sarah, you're up next.
First of all, this is very rude that you're just deciding my attachment style. You're doing exactly what I did that you didn't like.
Do you remember a minute ago when you said, bingo, we found Aaron's? Do you remember that? Because it was like 7 minutes
but
ago.
But you didn't like it.
And we have it on tape.
But you didn't like it.
Okay. Avoidantly attached people are similarly afraid that others will abandon them. But instead of clinging to avoid this outcome, they keep others at a distance. Intimacy signals to them that they could be hurt, so they push others away, eschew vulnerability, and leave relationships prematurely.
Okay.
Sarah?
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
Yeah. Listen, for me, I have the capability of having like a really rich friend group, I have some incredible women in my universe who I really need, but who I just don't know how to maintain it. Like, I don't know, like I don't respond to texts. I don't show up. I want to. And then I feel shame around it because then I feel lonely. And then when like shit happens, I'm like, oh, I have nobody to call. You know, like who can I go through this with? You know, there's not everything I can talk. You know, Erin is a very judgmental person. So it's hard for me to go to her for everything because she's very judgmental and very hard on me.
Okay, bring this back to you.
Okay, sorry. And I have like one best friend who is like the best and sees the best in me. And I think a lot of people think I have a million friends, but I don't feel like I do. And I know it's my fault because I just, anyways, you get it. You get me.
Yeah. What's the disconnect, Sarah, there? You mentioned like you want to show up, you want to reach out, but you just don't. What do you think's
happening?
Honestly,
I don't know. Like, I was thinking about it the other day. There was this person who I like love. I like love him. He's like literally one of my best friends. Like, he is the best. And I literally just like go weeks without responding to like a really thoughtful text. And I'm like, what is wrong with me? Like, it's not like I'm that busy. I mean, I'm no busier than like anyone else. Like I'm busy.
It's a choice to not respond.
It's a choice. And I always think that, I'll tell you what, like I'm sort of starting to unpack, is that I'll get a text or I'll get an invitation or something. And I want to like respond thoughtfully. So I just put it aside. I'm like, I'll do it later because I don't want them to think that my response is blasé or that my response isn't whatever. And then I don't go back to it. Does that make sense? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's almost like perfectionism.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I really want to be witty or thoughtful or
maybe just the intimacy is too intense for you.
Listen, I really struggle with intimacy. It's really hard for me to like hug people while I'm looking in their eyes. Intimacy is very hard for me. And I think there is intimacy in friendships. Like, it doesn't have to be romantic intimacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think I hugged you on your birthday.
You did not.
Okay, you didn't hug me on mine. I mean, it's like,
probably
hello?
Not. Listen, my husband is very secure attachment, like extremely. And he has sort of opened up my eyes to so much of our dysfunction because I didn't see it before. And he's always like, why don't you guys hug each other goodbye when you leave a restaurant or lunch or something? And I'm like, why would we hug goodbye? Like, I'll see her tomorrow. It's like, there's no need for it. And he thinks it's so crazy. But also, you know, Sarah's daughter recently, I put my arm around her. She goes, Auntie, I really don't like to get touched. I was like, what?
Oh God.
She goes, I don't like to be touched. I just don't like being touched.
Great.
I was like,
I spread it to her.
I was like, okay,
even though
Sarah.
I'm so affectionate with her. That's the thing though. I am like overly affectionate with my girls, which by the way, thank God, because I didn't know like, oh God, what if I become a parent and I'm not affectionate with them?
But she probably watches you not like affection. And I mean, you're the professional, you tell me.
Yeah, I mean, that can certainly be possible. Kids do pick up on how their parents show up in the world too. I'm not sure though. But I will say, you know, related to avoidant attachment, people that have an avoidant attachment, they tend to grow up with some parents who provided the basics, food, shelter, but were sort of emotionally neglectful, weren't there to fulfill your emotional needs. They were just there to fulfill your physical needs and kind of expected you to fulfill those emotional needs on your own. And so you really expect that intimacy is threatening. Like if people get closer to you, they are going to betray you, harm you. You don't necessarily trust them. And like avoidantly attached people, they actually report experiencing less joy in their friendships, right? Because that threat signal is also happening. Like even if this part of this is nice because I feel close, I also feel like something bad might kind of happen. I just have that gut feeling.
It's so interesting that you're saying that. I find myself in conversations with people where it's like an amazing conversation, but like I am not connected. Like truly, I can be one-on-one having like an amazing conversation, but I don't feel any electricity. Like I don't feel anything. And I walk away from it sometimes going, what is fucking wrong with me? Like, what is wrong with me? And it's so interesting what you're saying because Aaron and I always say we did have different childhoods. And I, to your point, like I had everything I needed. I had a home. I went to a good school. I had food. I had a nice life. But I really felt alone. Like I really felt like I raised myself. I really felt like there was no one guiding me. And that's just my own thing, even though I did have two parents who were alive and who did a lot for me. But
they were alive.
Yeah.
is a huge compliment.
Yeah. That sort of emotional piece, that ability to be attuned to you, to really connect with you, to connect with your emotions and what your needs are. That's important too.
I really need this right now because I am half asleep from jet lag. And even just seeing the ad for Calm has made me almost fall asleep.
I think, though, that so many people have the goal of starting a meditation practice. So many people feel like they want to dip their toes into meditating, but they don't know how to start. They don't know how to try. And that's why I love Calm, because you can really, they just make it so easy to start your meditation process. By the way, they have amazing programs for kids.
Yeah, putting them to sleep, like sleep stories and stuff.
There's just nobody that is above bettering themselves. There's nobody that doesn't need to
sort of reach that next dimension of inner peace. And we all need to better our mental health.
They are the number one mental wellness app, and it helps reduce stress and anxiety through guided meditations. And they have so many different kinds, like some are to improve focus, some are curated with music. They have like a rest and recharge. Like sometimes, for 15 minutes in the afternoon when you're getting tired, you can do a meditation that'll really help wake you up or like help you go to sleep at the end of the day. Like relaxing your mind if you feel a little panicky.
We now know that this works. We all know that connecting to that part of you, it works. Like the proof is in the pudding, and people have like real results when they start a meditation practice. So
exactly. And we have a really good discount for everyone. So for the listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/foster. Go to calm.com/foster for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That is calm.com/foster. Okay, I know this is an ad, but I'm genuinely obsessed with Element and I drink it all the time. I just had one yesterday on the airplane home from Italy because I also had to
brag about Italy or like your trips in September to Italy. Our listeners don't need to hear you bragging.
Just where? Okay. I went on a trip to an undisclosed location, and on my way home, I drank two glasses of wine on the airplane, and then I fell asleep. When I woke up, I had a raging headache and was so dehydrated, and I pulled out one of my little Element packs. I put it in the little water bottle, and I felt better.
Need your electrolytes replenished, it can give you tons of crazy symptoms, whether it's headache or exhaustion or nausea. That's like sometimes you really just need your electrolytes replenished. And
but the crazy thing that people don't realize is that Element has sodium in it. It tastes salty. It's like salty and sweet. And I've never tasted anything.
I do the
like
grapefruit one, the salty grapefruit.
I use the same. I like that one too. And the lime flavor is really good. But people use all these other brands that are really popular right now. They look at the ingredients, you guys.
They have sugar.
They have sugar. You do not need sugar in your electrolyte drink. This is a clean electrolyte drink that is healthy, that has no sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no fillers, no BS at all. It has sodium, it has potassium, and it has magnesium. These are such important things. They are vital to your body's peak.
Because if you don't have if you don't have the right ratio with all these things, it doesn't work, but this stuff does. Mm-hmm. It also just makes my skin glow because when you're hydrated,
it's all about the skin for you. It is all about the skin for you.
Yeah.
So here is our offer. Right now, Element is offering our listeners a free sample pack with any order. That is 8 single serving packets for free with any Element order. It's a great way to try all 8 flavors or share your Element with a salty friend. Get yours at drinkelement.com/foster. The deal is only available through this link. You have to go to drinkelement.com/foster. That you can try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, you can share it with a salty friend and they will give you your money back. No questions asked. You have nothing to lose. Again, that is Element without any of the vowels, just L-M-N-T.
There's some stuff from your book I want to read here that are sort of signals that your attachment style is at play. Mm. It says, when we assume without clear evidence that the only reason someone's reaching out to us is that they're bored and lonely, attachment is at play. When we wait for the other shoe to drop in an otherwise happy friendship, attachment is at play. Mm-hmm. When we feel an overwhelming but mysterious urge to withdraw, attachment is at play.
Ooh.
When we assume that others will disappoint us, judge us when we're vulnerable, or turn us down when we need support, attachment is at play. Ding, ding, ding. When we assume when we assume friends don't really like us to begin with, attachment is at play. When we allow people to only see our strong side, our jolly side, or our sarcastic side, attachment is at play. Ooh, didn't like that one.
We are to blame solely for our fucked up relationships.
When we maintain relationships with people who mistreat us, attachment is at play. Oh. So pretty much everything. Yep. So let's talk about how to strengthen our friendships. Hmm. I recently had my
40th birthday party. And
happy birthday.
Thank you. And I Sarah's rolling her eyes at me.
It's like, you're just okay.
And I, in my toast, I thanked all my friends who showed up for me and apologized to them for not always being a great friend or not always making the effort that I should make and that I want to make. And one of my girlfriends afterwards, she was like, I don't see you that way at all. I think that you make such a huge effort with me. And
oh, who was that?
Shelly.
Oh.
And one of my best friends, Sophia, who listens to this podcast, she was like, oh, it makes so much sense that you would show up for Shelly because Shelly's really, really direct. And she's like, I think that you do well with someone who's really direct. And Sophia and I admitted to each other that we're really passive aggressive with each other because we're really scared of being direct with each other because we've had fights in the past. And like, we don't want conflict. And so we don't, you know, we're not direct with each other. And I said to her, you know, I really think we need to like do a reset and be more direct with each other. And I want that in my friendship with Sophia so badly, but I'm so scared to do it. I'm really scared to say something annoyed me. I'm really scared to like call her on something. I'm scared for her to call me on something. And like, I don't know how to shift it, but I really want to.
Yeah. I really relate to this. I talk about in the book, in the chapter on anger and conflict, how like, your attachment style is a series of predictions in part, right? So if you're anxiously attached, it's like, if I bring this up, they're going to get super angry at me and abandon me. And it's going to be like when everybody topples a game of Monopoly, like your projection is really, really bad and really, really scary. So it's really hard to force yourself to do something that your body's telling you is just going to go so badly. But because we understand the signs of attachment, we can know that maybe things won't actually turn out like they expect. Like for me, I had a series of like small issues with one of my best friends, but I noticed I was starting to withdraw from the relationship. I thought I would just get over it, right? That's what I hoped as someone who was approaching conflict in a very anxiously attached way. It's like, it's my job to get over it. Not that big of a deal, right? Not validating my own needs like anxiously attached people tend to do. And I read this study. Funny how research is like my wisdom, but it found that open conflict is actually linked to deeper intimacy if you can do it in an empathic way. So I was like, oh, so I'm actually sabotaging my friendships by not bringing things up. Like it's actually making them less intimate. And there was this like psychoanalyst, Virginia Goldner, and she has these terms, placid safety, which means like you feel safe because nobody brings up anything wrong ever, versus dynamic safety, which is like rupture and repair, rupture and repair. We have fights, we make up, and we know that when issues come up, we can heal from them. So forever in the relationship, we're not scared if there's any problems because we know that there's like an escape hatch. We can actually talk about it. And so that's, I needed to know all that and hear it from like third party objective, which was the research study, to be able to like actually bring up problems with my friend. And now it's a little bit more normal. Like,
but how many things like should you bring up and how many things are just your own issue? Like we talked with Danielle about, and this sounds really stupid and you're a doctor, so you're going to be like, you're a loser, but it's okay. We talked about, look, the thing is like social media and how active you are on your friends' social media, it does affect you. Like when you have friends who you see so active and supportive and, you know, all over other people's pages on like congratulating them or supporting them or whatever, and they're just silent on yours, I'm so sorry. I'm not above being annoyed by that. I'm not above like having that hurt my feelings. I'm not above.
But you're saying it's got to be really petty to say to someone, like, you never like my Instagram. Yeah,
like I really can't imagine calling a friend and being like, hey, so I'm feeling a little bit insecure and a little bit hurt that you never like my photos. I mean, are you like, that just feels so fucking petty. But I guess the reality is I'm not the only one that feels this way. Like it is a thing.
Yeah, there's no objective criteria for like what's valid, right? And I would say like if it's something that starts to affect how you show up in the friendship where you're like, ah, this friend isn't commenting on my social media, so no, I'm not going to reach out to them as much. That's usually a sign that you're sort of not getting over it and that it might be worth it to address. And I know it's really awkward to address, especially these little things, But I think sometimes you can just use language like, hey, it makes me feel really loved when my friends comment on my social media or post things. And I've appreciated when you've done that. Like, would you be open to doing that more, for example?
Oh God, I don't know if I'm evolved enough
like
to say
positive
that.
Reinforcement instead of positive. Negative.
See, exactly. What I do is I just withdraw and go, fuck that person. That person's dead to me. You know, that's more where I go.
Mm-hmm.
That's healthy, right?
Very healthy.
No, but it's hard. I mean, look, I think this is an important thing to talk about because coming to your friends with your needs and coming to your friends with the things that hurt you, it's such scary territory. You have to be so vulnerable to do it. And it's scary. I mean, listen, I'm not good at it.
Well, I think what Marissa's point is that I'm picking up on that is important is that you feel less safe in a friendship where no one is bringing up any conflict because you don't know.
Because it feels fake.
Well, you don't know what you're doing that's bothering that person. You don't know if it really did offend them, that you were 15 minutes late to dinner, you know, when they said it was totally fine. You feel, I mean, I always, you know, say that, like, we can all feel each other's energy, right? Someone across the world that you've been in a toxic relationship with feels it when you get over them. Like, they feel it energetically, like you've removed themselves, yourself from them energetically. And people, you can feel when someone's annoyed with you or something. And it makes you feel unsafe thinking to yourself, they're telling me it's fine, but then are they going to text our other friend complaining about me later? Are they going to say it behind my back? Are they, you know, judging me for it, not telling me? So there's something about the friendship that I have with this one girl who's really, really direct. She has no filter. And sometimes she offends people. You know, sometimes she's really like can be harsh. Mm-hmm. But I know that if I do something that annoys her, she's going to tell me. So I feel really safe in the relationship because I know I can call her and be like, that was fucked up. And she can call me and say that was fucked up. And it's just clean.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like if nobody's bringing up issues, we would want to assume that there are no issues, but instead we assume there's all these issues, but we're not talking about them. And now I just have to like ruminate on what they could possibly be.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's talk about a situation where you are trying to get comfortable bringing things up in a friendship. To me, what I want to know from you, and maybe it's really simple, is, you know, there's the fear around what's going to happen afterwards. Are they going to abandon me? Are they going to hate me? Are they going to judge me? Are they going to be hurt by the things I say? Am I going to be hurt by the things they say? And that's the sort of the second part to it for me is I'm so scared to hear what they have to say. What if she says something that is really hard for me to hear? I'm so scared of hearing the criticism. Like, is what can you do to get more comfortable with that?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think it's about like staying, this is weird psychologist speak, but just staying grounded in your body, right? Like actually staying conscious and present with yourself, because usually when you're flying off the handle, you sort of got hijacked by a fight or flight response. So it's being able to not necessarily, people think authenticity is saying what reflexively comes to mind. And I don't think that. I actually think that our initial reaction is often inauthentic because it's defending against a deeper feeling we don't want to feel, right? I feel guilty. I feel ashamed. I feel bad as a friend. So instead, I'm going to tell you, you know, what you're saying doesn't matter. Fuck you. This doesn't make any sense, right? Instead, I say that instead of actually being present with like how I actually feel in my body. And so it's actually like really hard to engage in conflict well. It's about staying in a place where you're like regulating your emotions. It shouldn't be easy. Because if it's easy, you're just saying what you're acting out based on your defense mechanisms. It actually takes like, it's a very intense experience of being like, oh, that comes up. I want to be angry. I want to shut down. I want to attack you. I notice that instead of acting on it and instead try to say something that is going to bring us closer to some sort of resolution.
Okay, I would say that we have really a year and a half into this podcast. I would say that we are like the clean pushers, which honestly, I will take that. I will take that we are the clean pushers. Cookware guys, we've talked about bedding. We've talked to you about skincare.
I don't know how people don't realize or think about
this is like a no-brainer. This is really
a no-brainer. If you're using a nonstick pan and it is coated in something toxic, every single time you cook for yourself, for your kids,
it is going into
those they're called forever chemicals. The forever, that means that they will never leave your body. Okay. Forever chemicals are getting cooked into your food. It's really simple. You cannot use pans that have Teflon on them. You cannot use them.
Green pan is just, if you cook, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, so Green Pan introduced the world to ceramic nonstick cookware. They have 150 patents to prove it. They are the leaders in creating cookware without harmful toxic chemicals. So there's many reasons why using cookware that is ceramic is so much better.
Wait, you only use ceramic, right?
Yes. It doesn't emit fumes when it's cooked. It conducts heat evenly. It is very easy to clean up, and it allows you to cook with less oil or butter. So then you're cooking healthier food. They have full sets. They have frying pans, grill pans. They have woks. They have all the accessories. They have everything. Okay, so remember, healthy cooking is about more than just the food that you make. It is the products that you cook in it too. Right now, Green Pan has an exclusive offer just for the world's first podcast listeners. If you go to greenpan.us and use the promo code FOSTER, you're going to get 30% off your entire order, plus free shipping on any order over $99. Whether you buy one pan or a whole set, that is 30% off. So head to greenpan.us and use the promo code FOSTER.
Oh, Boll & Branch.
Oh my God.
Don't even have to look at the paper. Don't even have to look at the... Okay. So you know how there's like, how people are like, oh, I don't know, 100% organic sheets. They can't be that soft. They're probably rough. That might be true with other brands, but Boll & Branch has cracked the code on having 100% organic bedding being by far the softest bedding that I own, okay? The quality is truly next level. And listen, we're getting smarter. The consumer is getting smarter. We now know that the things that touch our body seep into our pores and go into our bloodstream. We know that. So it's like,
is that a scientific fact? What you just
again, I mean, I will say, maybe you think I'm a scientist. I should probably tell our listeners I am not a scientist. You might've thought I was.
So many people are going to be so surprised to hear that.
I know. It's probably the responsible thing to do to tell you I am not a doctor.
You're not a doctor or a scientist.
No, but we now know that when there are a lot of chemicals in the things you put on your body, it is not healthy.
They are 100% free from toxins, meaning there's no pesticides, no formaldehyde, or any other harsh chemicals ever touching their products.
And by the way, they're so confident that you'll love them that they will literally give you your money back after 30 days if you don't like them. So that's true. How confident they are.
It's true. You're not going to do that.
Give them their discount.
So, get 15% off your first set of sheets when you use the promo code FOSTER15 at bollandbranch.com. That is Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code FOSTER15.
What do you say to people who just can't make friends? Like, I can't tell you, do you get as many questions about... Because I think people view you and I as like people with really healthy female friendships. I think people view us as that of us having this like girl gang and like friends with all the same people that we were friends with since high school. And, you know, I don't know that people fully understand that you and I really do struggle with female friendships. So people ask me all the time, like, I'm depressed. I'm sad. I don't have community. I don't have a circle. Like, I'm craving girlfriends. Like, what would you say to those women?
I would say, don't assume that friendship happens organically, because as adults, it really doesn't. When we have continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability, meaning I see you every day and we get vulnerable with each other. We had that in school, right? Lunch period, recess. We had that sort of interaction, but as adults, we just don't, which means that like we can't use the same template we use as kids in our adult life of just waiting for friends to sort of pop into our life. And instead we have to initiate and we have to be a lot more intentional. Something that I like to tell people to make them a little less afraid is that according to the research, there's research study on this thing called the liking gap, which finds that when strangers interact, they underestimate how liked they are by the other person. So people are actually less likely to reject you than you think they are. And I think that's really helpful to keep in mind so that we can actually shoot our shot with friends and just say something as simple as, oh my gosh, it was so great to talk to you. I would love to stay connected. Would you be open to exchanging contact information and then following up with them?
Wow. I can't even picture you ever saying
that. Can you imagine? Because like there are women I really like who I'm not friends with. I can't imagine being like, I really like you. Would you be open to you and I mm-hmm. like taking this to the next level? Maybe we can text each other. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Can you, let's talk
well,
about.
Well, tell me more. Like what makes not be able to imagine it? What feels weird about it for you?
I don't know. It's just like, I'm really bad at putting myself out there. I'm really scared of rejection. So like, I'm really scared that the person would be like, in my mind, it'd be like, oh my God, I could just see her like talking shit about me behind my back being like, oh my God, Sarah's such a loser. She asked for my number. I don't know. Like it's all.
We really have an obsession with thinking people are talking shit about us.
I think because so many people have.
Well, Sarah, how would you respond if someone did that for
you? And by the way, it gets back to us people. If you're listening to this, it all gets back to us. So just know.
Sarah's really into revenge.
I have my hit
Okay,
list.
She's asking, she's trying to decide, analyze you. Can you let her do it?
I'm avoiding. Okay, go on.
If someone else was like, hey, like, I really love talking to you. Would you be open to exchanging contact information? And I'd love to connect again. What would you think or what would you feel?
If someone said that to me, I'd be so like flattered. I'd be like, oh my God, that's so nice that this person wants to like talk to me or like have a friendship with me or like, I'd be flattered. I would never be like, I don't think. I mean, I would be flattered.
Yeah. So that's one of the suggestions that I actually have because our predictions are so off when it comes to ourselves because we are scared and want to defend ourselves. So when we predict how social interaction will come off, we tend to be really off. So instead, it's helpful to ask yourself, how would this come off if someone did this for me? Like for me, I have a lot of trouble asking for support from friends. So I'll be like, how would I respond if this friend asked me for support? I'd be like, oh, I'm so happy to support them. I love them. And now I get to show it to make it feel a little easier for me.
It's a very good point. Because it's like, if you're uncomfortable thinking, oh God, if I ask that person to be there for me tonight, they're going to think it's so annoying. But then you reverse it and think, well, how would it feel if they asked me to be there for them? I'd be so excited at the opportunity. Like I do feel that from a lot of friends that most women I know are so desperate to know how to be a better friend and are so excited to show up for each other. It's like if we had something concrete, like God forbid, someone has cancer and is saying, hey, will you come to chemo with me? That is like a concrete thing that every woman I know in my life would be so honored and excited to show up for that person for something concrete because it's like they would know exactly what the person needs. They know how to show up for them. They know what to do to be, you know, to be able to say they're being a good friend. But it's not, exactly. It's not that tangible. Like typically we don't know what we're supposed to do. And most of our friends, we don't ask each other for help. And so we don't know how to show up for each other.
Yeah. And you know, this is where the research checked me. Discomfort with asking for support is related to having less intimacy in your relationships and surprise, surprise, being less likely to actually get supported. So.
Well, what are some ways that we can decode? I'm just trying to think now, like, what are the ways that I ask someone to show up for me without asking them? You know, like one of the things that I learned.
But then that's not being direct.
No. I'm saying what's a way that we can kind of start to understand that a friend does want us to show up for them when they're not able to ask for it.
Right. And then on the flip side, what if they just, you ask and they don't show up? Do you just like cut them off?
Well, okay. So one of the things that I was learning in the John Gottman book is that you have to be able to recognize a bid to connect from your partner, even if they're not really able to ask for it directly.
And it's like, the same with the platonic?
I mean, I don't know if she'll tell us, but I'm assuming it's the same that like if your partner says to you at night, oh cool, you're going to write more emails, then great, I'll start watching our show without you. That you have to recognize what they're really saying is,
I want to be with you.
I thought we were going to spend time together in bed and now you're working and I feel rejected by that. So I'm going to push you away and say like, fine, I'll just start our show on our own. Like clearly that person is saying like, I wanted you to get in bed with me and get off your phone, but they're not able to say it. So you have to try to recognize it. So it's got to be the same in friendships, right?
Yeah. I think absolutely. I think with friendships, it can be even harder to read, right? Because you're not around each other all the time and you're somehow supposed to figure out what each other needs. And I think tips for friendship and navigating friendship around support is like when someone's going through a difficult time, asking if they need something specific. Is it helpful if I bring over some groceries? Is it helpful if I babysit your kid? Is it helpful if I walk your dog? So that it takes, because it's kind of a burden to figure out how you need support when you need support too. So giving them those specific options, I think, is a way to open up the bidding process.
Someone recently told me that I was talking to, well, it's not somebody, it's my therapist.
Barbara.
Barbara and I were having a conversation about people who always kind of hijack your experience and make it about themselves. You know, when you're going through something and they like, when I lost this person in my life, and then it just becomes about them. And we were talking about just how to navigate that and how to make sure you're not being that person and how to handle when somebody else is being that way. And she said, you know, a great way to make sure you're not ever doing that is when someone's sharing something difficult that they're going through, you could say, would it be helpful if I share an experience that I had that was similar to that? You ask them and then they could be like, honestly, no, I don't want to hear that story. Or like, yes, please, that's helpful. Instead of just immediately taking over the story and making it about you.
I like that. Go, Barbara.
Right? I like that for sure. But I also think it would be so awkward for someone to be like, no, I'm good. I don't want to hear your story. Of course, they're going to be like, okay, yeah, true. Let's hear it. And then they're going to be like, Jesus Christ, always no, about her.
Listen,
always about her.
Sometimes, like, I've been going through a lot of IVF stuff, and sometimes I don't want to hear somebody else's story about their sister's best friend who got pregnant, you know, through some other means that, like, I don't have access to, or that I've tried all the things. And when someone's like, okay, I have a story to tell you. And sometimes I'm like, I love you. I know you're coming from a good place, but I've heard all the stories. Like, I don't want to do it, you know, and it's not hurtful, but I would love if people would ask me first if it would be helpful before they would launch into their quick fix stories.
But
you
that's
know?
Someone else's attachment style and their weird shit when they feel like in that moment they need to share their story so that they can get attention on them, or that they can be the hero making you feel better by sharing their story, right? Like, that's their, because I know a few people who always do that. I'm like, shut the fuck up. Just sit there and listen. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't need your dumb story that is actually not relevant at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love what you said here in the book. You said, we've all heard the saying, love yourself before someone can love you. But what does that mean exactly? And how does that self-regard happen?
Yeah. So this is interesting. While I was doing research for the book, I came across this theory on like how we develop self-esteem. It's called the sociometric theory. And they basically define self-esteem as a reflection of how you think other people perceive you. It's a reflection of whether you think other people value you. It's not as much just how you feel about yourself, but how you think you're coming off to others. And so knowing that, that's why the assuming people like you thing is so important, not only for us to create connections with other people, but to feel a higher sense of worth ourselves. Because, you know, I think there's so much reciprocity between how people treat us and how we begin to treat ourselves internally.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. It's so true. But how can you like shut out the voices, you know? Because I'm totally a victim of that, of if someone else like, you know, tells me that I'm talented, I'm like, oh my God, I'm talented. Like, why can't I just know like I'm talented and I don't need someone else to tell me that I'm talented. Like, how do you shut out those outside voices and not make those voices the loudest in the room and so powerful? Like, how can you find it within yourself no matter what someone else thinks about you or says about you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, Rick Hansen, he's a psychologist. He has really great work on this, that when we feel bad about ourselves, when we're insecurely attached, our brain naturally focuses on those negative moments. They're rejecting me, their voice changed, right? Like, it's just, that's what we're primed to do. And we just ignore all the positive, and then it just continues. The cycle continues. So he really suggests, when you have a signal of safety, when someone smiles at you, they sent you that thoughtful text, they responded to you, they showed up in those times of need, actually taking a moment to like savor each time that you're safe, like focus on it and let it stir some joy in your body. Don't just let it pass you by, because then I'm not going to get deep into the science here, but you release these hormones and neurochemicals that actually begin to change your brain structure so that you now are better at attuning to the positive and less likely to just attune to the threats.
I wonder if like our self-esteem, and I think mine is definitely worse than yours, but I wonder if there's a correlation to it with like rejection. Like we felt rejected by our dad, even though he just left our mom, you know, but as a kid, you're like, that's rejection. Like where he left because he doesn't love us or want to be with us.
You so, personalize everything as a kid. Right?
Yeah, you personalize everything as a kid. So that was rejection. And then you and I both decided to go into acting, which is basically rejection every single day. Every single day you're being told you're not pretty enough, you're not talented enough, you're not good enough, you're not this enough. Like it's rejection truly every single day. And I wonder if that like played a role for me. I don't know. You know, I mean,
I think more for you maybe than me.
Maybe more for me. I mean, I started, Just rejection.
I mean, that would make sense.
Well, because don't you repeat the patterns of your childhood? Like you seek out the thing that feels safe and normal to you, which is what you're used to, which is the feeling of rejection, right?
Familiarity is indeed a drug, yes.
Right. Okay, let's talk about the, is anxious attachment the last attachment style? It's just the last one on this page.
It's three. There's three.
Yeah, there's three. There's actually four. I just want to mention this. Disorganized attachment, which is people that have gone through more severe abuse. There's just a lot less research on that, but I like to nod to those folks who don't feel like people talk about their attachment style enough.
Okay, so definitely tell us about that one after we talk about anxious attachment, because I know that that one's like a combination, right? So you can talk about that one. So anxious attachment style. You will meet them at a party and ask how they're doing, and they'll tell you about their childhood trauma, their surgery, their their suicide
oversharer over here.
Their suicidal urges. That's not me. Hoping the vulnerability will entreat you. Wow, that's me. Secure people, in contrast, let relationships unfold over time, and critically, while they are trusting, they adjust their initial optimism based on feedback they receive from others in real time. You know, it's so interesting, the like the need to talk about childhood trauma and a surgery or whatever and hoping their vulnerability will entreat you. Because I obviously do that. So I guess I have a double dose of both of the unhealthy attachment styles. But there's something you said earlier that for me is really why I think I do that. You talked about how in friendships, and it seems like specifically female friendships, you never want to be better or worse than each other. And whenever I get a compliment or if I feel like I look cute at a party or some girl comes up and is like, oh my God, you know, you're so skinny, or, oh God, you have such pretty hair or something like that, I immediately feel this need to lower myself and say something very, self-deprecating to balance it out because I want that girl to like me.
Right. She said you don't want to feel too dominant.
Yeah. And I get nervous like, oh, if she thinks that my hair's too pretty tonight or I'm too skinny or something and she's envious of that, then she's not going to like me. And I want her to really like me. So I want her to know that like, oh, I'm only pretty because I had a nose job, or, oh, you think I'm skinny, but I have cellulite, or like whatever the thing is that I can balance.
You actually don't have
cellulite. I actually don't have cellulite. But if I did, but like to balance it out because I don't want that girl to think that I feel.
How do you not have cellulite? It's actually crazy. This is for another episode, but it's just like, it's just insane.
I mean, I have a little bit.
Sorry, you really don't.
Anyway, it's just this uncomfortable feeling that I never want anyone to think that I think I'm better than them. I don't ever want to feel above. I want to feel relatable. That's like where
you're obsessed with feeling relatable. Yeah, and you are. You're very relatable.
That's rude. but you know, listen, I had this like blossoming happen for me when I was a teenager.
It's called a glow up.
Yeah, I had a big glow up. Okay, in my 20s.
By the way,
and
it wasn't that big of a glow. I mean, you also like
no. If you were to look at old pictures of me on the internet, it looked like I had like facial reconstructive surgery. Like I like lost 30 pounds. I got all this. I look like a different person. And I did get a nose job and I lost weight, but
you
it just
double
kind of
D boobs,
I just
sort of, if only people knew.
I had a transformation, and when I had that transformation, I felt people interacting with me differently. All of a sudden I was like the hot girl. I was the pretty girl in the room. I wasn't the like wallflower. I wasn't the like awkward, you know, dorky, chubby sister. And in a lot of ways, it felt amazing. Let me be clear. But it also felt like I had abandoned myself, or I'd abandoned these girls that related to me and connected to me. And I used to hate those hot girls because they made me feel bad about myself. So I was so scared to become one of them. And so I think I always, you know, say something to drop me down because I really want to make sure that I'm not like hateable. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And you know, I don't know if you've heard of the psychology theory, internal family systems, but it basically argues that our self now is also all the selves we've had before. Like, we don't just get over it and move on. Like, our teenager self is still within us. Like, our kindergartner self is still within us. The abandoned child is still within us. And sometimes they can peek out when they feel triggered in those moments. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for saying that, because I think people feel shame around, like, you know, God, like, I'm old. Like, why haven't I worked through all this shit? And it's like, thank you for saying that, because the reality is, you know, it doesn't just go away.
No,
you can work on yourself, and you can quiet the voice, but it doesn't just fucking go away. And I think, like, you know, we have parents who are like, oh, you should move on, blah, blah. It's like, no, I'm sorry. Like, I should, yes, you move on in your own way, but it doesn't just go away. And I, and I think, like, as a parent, as a daughter, like, whoever's listening, you should not feel shame if you are still affected at 30 years old or 40 years old or 50 years old by things that happened to you when you were a kid. You just shouldn't feel shame around it.
Yeah. And it's basically, you can think about it as learning, right? Your brain learns things from your environment to help you adapt in the future, right? The problem is that not every environment is like your childhood environment. So you end up missing out on different opportunities or not even seeing them because you assume that things are the same, but it's your brain's way of learning and helping you to survive in the future that you hold on to these old patterns. And when we're children, we're particularly vulnerable to learning in these really deep ways. So I think you're absolutely right that we don't just get over it. Like, we really need to intentionally do some work on some of these issues that we have. And it's more normal to not get over it than it is to just get over it.
I have a question. This isn't on the thing, but what are the attachment styles that are the best match for each other? Or is it just like staying within your attachment style? Or,
well, I was literally to that point looking at a question here, and it says, I'm anxious attached. What kind of partner should I be looking for, knowing this is a tendency? Or maybe what kind of friendship?
Yeah. Well, basically all of the attachment styles will heal from being attached to securely attached people. So they're sort of the attachment style that all of us want to pair with, because if you're anxious, right, you fear other people are going to abandon you. If you pair up with an avoidant person, they just might, right? And you're just going to continue to compound these issues that you have. Secure people are the people that show you your predictions aren't true. You know, you're trying to address a problem with a secure person and they're still invested in the friendship. And they're like, thank you, you told me, right? That's the sort of thing that alters the predictions that are really engraved in our attachment styles and help us become more secure ourselves.
Oh my God. So we just need to find secure attachment people and attach ourselves to them. And
I don't know if you should like hook your thing to their wagon.
I
or
feel
whatever.
Like all the securely attached people I know, like, don't want to be friends with me. I feel like I try.
Who are they?
Oh my God. Okay.
I mean,
well, Erin, would you say that happened for you? Because I know you said your current relationship partner is more securely attached. Do you find it affecting how you attach?
I think a little bit.
Yes. I mean, in my friendship, well, listen, like, you know, so my friend Sophia listens to this podcast, and she and I have a really, really intimate friendship and a soulful friendship. And we got into a conflict a year or so ago, and I was really rattled by it. And my instinct was pull away and never speak to each other again, because I was so scared to have the conversation we needed to have. And Simon was like, no, you need to have a conversation. This is someone you love. This is someone you care about. This is someone you want in your life who has good intentions. You have good intentions. You have to sit in a room. And I was so scared to sit in the room, and I was so uncomfortable with it that he moderated like a conversation between the two of us. We met at a neutral place at his office in the conference room.
Wait, you never told me about this.
Yeah, you knew about this.
I did not.
No, you did. You just made me forgot. And he moderated for us, and he forced me and her to have the conversation. She was much more willing to have the conversation than I was, because I was so uncomfortable with the conflict in a friendship that felt safe to me. I was so scared that we had had conflict all of a sudden. And so he really, really pushed me and forced me to have the conversation, because for him, those conversations aren't easy to have, but are possible to have. And so that really helped me push through something that would have otherwise probably been the ending of a friendship unnecessarily. So wow. Yeah, it helps me a lot because I can see the world through his perspective.
Which is a healthy perspective.
As a secure, attached person. So something will happen and I'll go, oh, that thing, that's fucked up. And he'll be like, just tell them that it hurt your feelings. Or, you know, he'll make me show up as a friend in a different way. Like, you know, you got to call that person and check in on them. And reminds me of the things that I'm not trying to do badly, but I literally don't necessarily know how to do properly. Like, sometimes things feel too intimate to me. So I just pull away. I don't want to call that person when they're going through the thing because it's too uncomfortable for me. And so I've learned a lot by just like witnessing the world through a securely attached person's viewpoint.
That's so beautiful. And that makes a lot of sense because like, if you think about it, right? Anxious and avoidantly attached, even if you're like on the secure spectrum, and I do think attachment is a spectrum. If someone's super avoidant, that's inherently going to make you anxious, right? Like someone's like, I'm going to pull away. I'm going to ghost on you. You know, we're going to get closer and all of a sudden you're going to stop talking to me and I don't know why, right? That's just going to bring out your anxiety. And similarly, if you're with someone who's very anxiously attached, putting all this pressure on you, making all these demands of you, wants you to be vulnerable super quickly, right? Like expects you to show up for them in XX way to prove that you're their friend. You're going to feel like, oh my gosh, I need to create some space. I need to have some autonomy. I need my sense of identity back. And so that is why we anxious and avoidantly attached people tend to really trigger each other, but they also tend to be in relationship with one another because, you know, if you think about avoidant attachment style, not investing in relationships much at all because they're so threatened by them. If you're secure and someone's not really investing in you, you move on. If you're anxious, that's a sign that, oh, now I need to try harder. I need to work harder to make sure that I get them to like me, right? It's called fawning. We fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, which means we respond to threat by really trying to get people to like us more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
And, you know, it seems like you can kind of bounce around between all the different unhealthy attachment styles based on who you're attracting in your life at that time. When I was single, I was an insecure attached person. I was drawn to avoidance 1,000,000%. And I would become whatever it would be, clingy or like insecure and all that. But then sometimes I would attract another anxiously attached person or an insecure attached person. And as soon as they would act insecure with me and anxious with me, I would become avoidant and I would like want nothing to do with them because I would find it so unattractive. And so then I'd feel kind of cool. Like, oh, look at me. I'm an avoidant. Like I love being an avoidant. It's so cool. I'm so untouchable, you know? But the truth is I wasn't. I was just like, you know, avoiding someone that felt like me, you know, and I never was attracted to secure attached people because when I would act out, they would look at me and be like, pull your shit together. It didn't do anything for them. You know, it took
so
much. You
get the response you wanted almost.
Exactly. Because I wanted the response to be like engaging with it, you know, fanning the fire. I liked that idea. And, yeah. and you know, the other thing that people don't talk about enough is that when you are in a relationship with someone that is fucked up, unhealthy, chaotic, you know, not trustworthy, it takes all the focus off of yourself. So I was always in relationships with people that were doing the bad thing. Mm. And all of our energy was focused on blaming them. When I got into a relationship with someone who was healthy, I had to take a really uncomfortable look at myself because sometimes my behavior was problematic and I had never been the focus in any of my relationships. If you date someone who's cheating on you all the time, you're not really going to focus on your insecure attachment style.
Yeah. You're going to be like, it's them. I'm good. It's not me. If only they were different.
Exactly. It was always them. So being with a secure attachment style person takes a lot of growth because your dysfunction is highlighted.
Oof. That's a word.
Yeah. And that's uncomfortable.
Yeah. Why is a friendship ending more difficult than like a love story? And this is something that like, it's really weird. Like if I fight with Tommy, okay, it is not nearly as cellular. It doesn't hit me on the cellular level as it does if I fight with a girlfriend. Now, maybe it's because we have two kids, like where the fuck is he going? You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. girlfriends can just leave. I don't know. But like,
yep.
and I think that this is relatable to other people. There's something about a fight with a girlfriend, with a platonic girlfriend that just is impossible to shake. It just hits you differently.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny, right? If you think about a marriage and like, could you ever be in a marriage where you never actually had conflict and never talked through conflict, right? But somehow we assume that that's how friendship should be, like positive vibes only. We never have a conflict. It's like it has to be perfect for it to be safe. And so when you have that conflict in friendships, because, you know, according to the research, people are just less likely to address conflict in friends with friendships than they are with their spousal partnerships. What happens is all the alarm bells go off because you're like, something's off. This isn't normal for friendship, right? Like, this isn't like part of what a normal, healthy friendship is. And when in fact, it absolutely is part of what a healthy friendship it is and part of what a healthy friendship looks like. So I think it gives us this particular form of fear. And part of it is that, you know, friendship is so ambiguous, right? Like there's a study that found that half of the people we consider friends don't consider us friends. So
wait.
I know.
I'm sorry.
Isn't that wild?
I'm sorry. Half of the people that we consider are our friends actually don't consider us their friends.
Exactly.
So that means I have no friends. Because if half of one is none, right?
Half of one is none.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you definitely have no friends.
I have no friends.
Jen Meyer thinks of you as a friend. That's pretty much it.
Right, but she doesn't because 50%. Right. Okay, so I have one friend. Okay. Wait, that's crazy.
Isn't it? So that makes it so hard and extra scary and feel extra insecure, right? Because like we don't know whether someone's invested in us like we are in them.
But how is that possible? How can I think someone's my friend when they're like, I'm not friends with that bitch? How is that possible? Right.
I don't exactly know why.
You're like, I didn't make up that stat.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side, I've had a few girlfriends where I've said to them in arguments or in whatever, like, dude, I am not your wife. Stop putting this pressure on me. Like, I'm sorry I didn't call you back. I have children. I have a job. I have a marriage. Like, cut me some slack. I'm not mm-hmm. your fucking wife. So I've mm-hmm. had that, right? Where I feel like there's too much pressure. I'm like, I'm not in a romantic relationship with you. Like, mm-hmm. you have to, like loosen the reins a little bit. Like, cut me a little slack as your friend.
Yeah, and that different levels of expectations, I think, are another problem in friendship, just because it's so ambiguous and friendship can occur on such a spectrum.
Well, that probably also comes in, and this is an important part of friendship, is when you're at different places in your life. So mm-hmm. it's hard for a single girlfriend to understand the role of the husband or what her role is in your life, because for her friendships are her primary relationship. But mm. for you, your marriage might be your primary relationship or your children might be your primary relationship. And right. that can be really challenging in a friendship when you don't understand, you know, where that person's priorities got messed up. So for Sarah, you know, it might be a single girlfriend of hers where that girlfriend is expecting for you guys to be each other's primary relationship. But for you, she's fifth on the list.
Yeah,
exactly.
So how do you handle a situation like that?
You know, I think if a friend expects more of me than I do of them, or wants to be closer to me than I do from them, I'd probably start with a more like indirect route and figure out whether they might get the hint. Unfortunately, sometimes they don't get the hint. And I might just have to say, like, hey, like, I really want to make sure you get the support you need. And this is what's going on in my life. So I know that I'm not always able to show up for you in the ways that you might want. Is there someone else that we might bring in that might be able to give you this support?
It's so hard because, like, there are certain people in my life who, when I speak to them, they are always complaining. Always complaining. Always pointing fingers. Always mad about something. Always bringing up the past. And I guess like I do need to be more direct, but like it's hard because then you get scared. Like I don't want to hurt that person because they're obviously in pain, or I don't want them to then not want to be my friend. But like what I do is I just fully pull away, and that's worse.
Yeah, that hurts more.
But that
exactly.
hurts more.
Yeah, I think that's so real. Like, we're like, let me not bring up this conflict because I don't want to make things worse. But literally, if you withdraw, it's actually a lot worse. And that's usually the other option when we don't bring things up.
How do you know if you are in a toxic friend relationship? Like, what are the red flags?
Yeah. So generally, when you're in a toxic friend relationship, one person is completely getting their needs met and the other person isn't getting their needs met at all. And so your friend expects you to go out of your way for them, but isn't willing to meet you halfway. It's a breakdown. And what happens when we become friends with someone is we include them in our sense of self, which means that when they're happy, we feel happy. When they're sad, we feel sad. We feel a natural pull to sort of want to meet their needs because we love them. And in toxic relationships, that's not necessarily happening. You also might see things like they're not happy for your success and accomplishments, which is a sign that there's a breakdown in the inclusion of them in your sense of self. They also might be downright malicious and just say negative things about you. And also you might find yourself being toxic, right? Because toxic people don't necessarily respond to reasonable and healthy dynamics. So you may start acting out of character in response to the toxicity that they're bringing into the relationship. And that's also a sign that it might be toxic.
This is a thing we talk about because we talk a lot about the dynamics of women. And we talk about what it feels like when women don't actually support women. Like everyone's like, oh, women supporting women, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, how do you handle a female in your life who you just know doesn't wish the best for you? For her, she loves you. She'd say you're her friend. But deep down, your successes like anger her.
Mm. Yeah, that is maybe a sign that it's not the best friendship to invest in. I feel like if you feel like you can address it, you can. But also the other thing that's magical about friendship is like, you don't have to break off friendships. You could also dial down the level of intimacy. Like I use the term low-dose friends for those friends that I'm like, I love to hang out with you once a month, any more than that. And I don't know if I could take it, but like, that's what's nice about friendship. We have that flexibility.
Low dose friendships, right? Yeah. There are certain people that are fun in small doses that are like perfectly fine, but that you just, it's okay to not fully go all in because maybe you can't totally trust them because maybe they are just too unhealed for you to allow that energy into your world because we are so susceptible to other people's energy. Like, you know how you can be around certain people and you're like, I need to just like shower to like rid myself of that energy that is now all over me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like how you called it unhealed. I think that's a really compassionate way to talk about it.
Well, I've seen it in my, I think that that is really what it is. Because if you look at the female who isn't that happy for you and that maybe says things behind your back, like what's going on with her? Like what kind of shit is she dealing with that is so unhealed that she has to project that shit on me when it really isn't about me?
Mm. Yes.
Guys, am I a philosopher?
Mm-hmm. So how can we, I'm sure it's a very big conversation and obviously, you know, everyone should buy your book and read more about this.
Hell yeah.
Then you'll get a real in-depth look, but how can we change our attachment style?
We all need to attach ourselves to Simon.
Yeah. There's a few different ways. And I do talk about this a lot in the book. And because I kind of talk about the ways that secure people tend to handle things and handle relationships, and just beginning to practice those skills and tools can make you start to feel more secure. Like you do the secure behaviors and you become more secure, right? So that can look like I'm actually going to bring up conflict and I'm going to bring it up in a way where I'm not attacking or blaming you. I'm going to share, hey, I wanted to work through this because our friendship's so important to me. Like I felt hurt when this happened. What was going on for you in that moment? You're sort of de-escalating, right? Another secure behavior that we see is like mutuality, which means I'm considering your needs and I'm considering my needs at the same time. So now when I think if a friend is hurting me, I start checking myself and think what's going on in their life? Am I negative filtering, which is a tendency of insecurely attached people where I'm only seeing the ways that I think they slighted me. I'm not seeing the larger dynamics in the friendship, all the things that they are doing to invest in me. And so it requires us to really check ourselves in these ways. I think one thing that the book really does for people is that, like I said, attachment style is a series of predictions. It's if I try to work through conflict, you're going to blow up on me. If I'm vulnerable, you're going to reject me, right? But the research in general shows us that we're a lot safer than we think. Like studies find that we're a lot less likely to be rejected than we think. When we're vulnerable, people like it more than we think. It actually creates more intimacy. When we show affection for people, they think it's less awkward than we assume. They actually like it better than we think. So that's why it's also just helpful, I think, to understand some of the research and the actual reality that's happening, so we can adjust some of these predictions that are within us. And then the last thing I'll just say is, like, assuming people like you and savoring moments and signals of safety and making that a practice over time can really improve your attachment style.
That's really good advice. Really good advice. Well, Marissa, really this is advice. Like fascinating. I mean, everybody needs to get your book.
I also think too, just being aware of your attachment style, just being like aware, once you've figured out who you are, then you can really just be cognizant and try to change that behavior. Like, I think so many people are probably going to be like, oh my God, this, like, it's so eye-opening, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you and I have been doing the work for a long time, so we're kind of like in touch with our attachment style. But like, there are a lot of people listening to this who haven't started. We have a lot of young people listening to this, like people in their teens, in their early 20s. Like, so how amazing for you to grab a hold your patterns now, because how beautiful, you can literally change.
And if you're a young woman listening to this, I think that it's so important to know that you are starting the map of your female friendships for the rest of your life. And it's so important to have women who have seen you through all the different seasons of your life and accept you for all those different seasons. And, you know, we're not always our best selves. And it's okay if a friend has a hard time around you while you're going through that terrible breakup and you can't stop talking about it. And then they forgive you for it and they give you another chance. And then you, you know, repay the favor for them when they're going through something difficult. And like you're saying, like, friendship should not have to be expected to be perfect all the time. It should be flawed. It should be complex. It should be difficult and argumentative sometimes, but then you repair it. You know, it's like, it's weird if somebody said, oh yeah, we've been married for 20 years and we've never had a fight. Yeah, we've never had a fight. You'd be like, well, you're in denial.
You're operating like so on the surface that you're not going deep enough. Like, I do say that about female friendships. I'm like, wait, you've never disagreed or fought? You're obviously in like a fake friendship.
Yeah.
But is that true?
I mean, I think it probably depends on the level of intimacy. If it's an intimate friendship, I would say, yeah, you're probably not, maybe you're not addressing some conflict that has arose. But if it's a more shallow friendship, then things can sort of happen in passing that may feel easier to let go of. The closer we get to people, the more they affect us.
But if you're, Marissa, if you're bringing things up effectively, then you're probably not like arguing per se in the friendship, right? If you're saying, you know, I got to be honest, it really annoys me that you're always late when we have dinner and like I'm always on time. And if that person's going like, shit, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize that annoyed you, I'll get better at it.
You're saving yourself a fight for the future.
Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like Jeff Simpson is this academic I interviewed about conflict. And one of the things he said, which I think is great for securely attached people, is that when other people escalate, they de-escalate. So it's almost hard to get into an argument with them because they're always trying to bring it back down.
Yes. Yeah, it's so interesting because like I always try to like pick fights with Simon, and he does this thing really well, which is I think the term's like mirroring. Like he mirrors me very well. So if I say I'm really annoyed, he's like, I totally get that would be annoying.
Oh,
I'm
that like, would annoy me so much.
And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, he just understood me. So I guess like, I have to find something different to fight about then, you know? Like, because he's always like, yeah, no, I see where you're coming from. Like if I go up to him, I'm like, so-and-so did this fucking thing. And like, she wrote this comment on Instagram and it's annoying. He's like, yeah, that would annoy me too. And I'm like, oh, okay, great. We're on the same page here. Like I feel very validated. So it's really hard to pick a fight with him because he like,
why is it annoying to me, you guys, when people like when I say something and a girlfriend is like, I hear you? Why does that annoy me so much? Is it it's like condescending or something?
Marissa's like, I don't know, because it's a healthy thing your friend
Marissa's
to say.
Like, dude, I don't know. You need therapy twice a week, not once a week.
Oh, Lord. Marissa's like, Lord. I can't diagnose you. But if I was going to, you have all the bad attachment styles. Marissa,
all right, this was fantastic.
Yeah, really, really helpful. And I feel like I've had a really good, healthy therapy session. And I feel like I'm going to inject a little bit more directness in my friendships and try to like approach conflict differently or approach
not
it
with
at
me,
all.
Though. I don't need more directness from you. Just leave me out of this. Oh, your newfound, you know, healthy attachment style.
Oh, got it. Okay. I'll test out some other people.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like what I want to just share with your listeners too is that it's easy to listen to these conversations on attachment style and be defeatist. Like, oh, I didn't have a healthy childhood. So good for all those people with healthy childhoods, right? But I think it's really empowering to know, because I think before you know and understand attachment theory, you're just like, people are cruel. Like, I can't trust people. People are mean, because you don't necessarily realize how your interactions and your behaviors in the world are causing you to focus on, nurture relationships with people that don't have your best interests at heart, or ignore those moments of safety. So I think it's really empowering, because when you realize how your own behaviors impact your relationships, you realize that you can also fundamentally change them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like, everyone needs to get your book.
Yes. Please get her book. It is called Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Marissa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It was my pleasure.
We really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. This is so good.
If you like this podcast, leave a rating and review.
This podcast is executive produced by...
Can you not use that voice?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to sound...
Yeah, but you don't need to make it sexy.
This podcast is executive produced by...
Do you have a normal voice?
Yeah. Aaron Foster, Sarah Foster, and Allison Bresnick.
Okay, I'll take over. Our associate producer is Montana McBierney. Our audio engineer is Josh Windisch. This show is hosted by Simplecast.
See, that didn't sound nice.
That sounded great.